Commodores Entertainment v. Thomas McClary and Fifth Avenue Entertainment. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Dorothy Easley on behalf of Thomas McClary, founding member of the Commodores and Fifth Avenue Entertainment. We're here today on the granting of judgment as a matter of law on phase one issue of ownership on 54B certification and the granting of a worldwide injunction that precludes Thomas McClary from basically everything of the use of his name in the same sentence with the Commodores.
Is that true? Did they really object to the characterization, for instance, that you just used?
Can you repeat the question?
You introduced him as Thomas McClary, founding member of the Commodores.
Yes, that's correct.
There's an objection. They object to that, the use of that phrase?
No, Your Honor, that phrase has not been presented, and that's one of the problems with the injunction order. And what I'd like to do is there are three issues that I'd like to address today, and that's one of the issues that I'd like to address, because these are critical questions, and I think Your Honor is hitting the point. So the first issue would be the issue of ownership of the mark. That's critical because the judgment as a matter of law found an abandonment as a matter of law, and there's countervailing, contradicting evidence, which I'm happy to provide to the court with record sites. I'll get to that. The second issue we'd like to address today for purposes of oral argument is the worldwide injunction and the problems with the worldwide injunction. The third issue we'd like to address today for oral argument purposes is Thomas LePred, the indispensable party, and the failure to join him and denial of the motion to dismiss, which is inextricably intertwined with the ownership issue. So before I move to those, addressing Your Honor's questions, I think that this is a case where the forest, and not just the trees, is extremely important because the whole reason for trademark law, the whole purpose for its existence, is not simply to preserve, protect the legacy and the authenticity of the creation, but also to protect the rights of the individual owners to that mark. In the case of bands, multiple joint owners. So to address Your Honor's question, let me take this out of order, which is the issue of the worldwide injunction. There are procedural problems with the worldwide injunction and substantive problems with the worldwide injunction.
So maybe start with the substantive, because I think you said a few minutes ago that the worldwide injunction prohibits the use of Thomas McClary's name effectively in the same sentence with the word Commodores.
That's correct.
My understanding was that the injunction actually wouldn't preclude the use of the introduction that you made here, Thomas McClary, founding member of the Commodores, but would preclude use in a promotional sense.
Your Honor, actually, the injunction, I'm reading the injunction order itself because this is odd in the sense that the judgment as a matter of law took an injunction order that on page one, footnote one, states has no factual findings or conclusions of law that have any effect whatsoever on the later trial. And yet the judgment as a matter of law, without taking any additional evidence, reaches back to the injunction order. And the judgment as a matter of law says you cannot use the terms the 2014 Commodores, you cannot use the term of Thomas McClary, the Commodores featuring Thomas McClary, and then leaves wide open the notion of fair use. So it never goes through the bullet of factors, and it can't go through the bullet of factors because it
Didn't
never takes any evidence.
CEC and its officers unambiguously say they do not object to McClary billing himself as, quote, Thomas McClary, founder of the Commodores, and that, quote, McClary is free to make fair use of the Commodore's mark to provide historically accurate information about his tenure as Commodore?
Well, Your Honor, yes, they do. Now, let me explain why that's problematic.
So it would be fair and accurate, would it not, to say in response to Judge Newsom's question that both the name McClary and Commodores could be used in the same label, the same statement, the same effort to disgorge this to the public? Is that not right?
No, Your Honor.
That's
let
not
me
right
explain
when
why.
I have it wrong?
Yes, but respectfully, yes, but let me explain why. And maybe
please.
I have it wrong, and Your Honor's
could
tell
be.
Me why.
I'm wrong about it, but I thought they said they don't care if you use the name McClary in relationship to and describing him specifically as the founder of the Commodores.
Here's the fundamental problem. We can't agree on what fair use is. He should be entitled to say the Commodore's apostrophe, Thomas McClary. He is a founding member, even if he has no longer any rights.
Yes, but your statement was more sweeping than that. Your statement in response to Judge Newsom's question, simply put, was there was no way the name McClary and Commodores could appear in the same sentence, the same phrase, the same clause, and in fact they say you can use it.
Here's
in
the
that
problem.
Matter.
The problem is we cannot agree on fair use, so that's why
well, they
I
agree
bring
that would
back
be fair. They agree that would be fair use.
They agree that, and then what if he uses the term the Commodore's Thomas McClary, which is factually accurate, the Commodore's founder Thomas McClary, which is factually accurate? Then what happens? Is he going to be hit with another injunction, a TRO injunction? Is he going to be hit for violation of the injunction? Because they cannot agree on fair use, what does and does not constitute fair use. And at some point, we have to get this court to clarify what is fair use, because fair use is that which, even assuming he is not a trademark owner, this is why I want to drive this issue
so
forward.
What you'd like this court to do, if I have it right.
I would like
let me ask my question, please.
Certainly, I'm sorry.
What you'd like this court to do, if I have it right, is to hypothesize about other possible uses beyond the ones that they said they have no objection to.
No, Your Honor. I'm not asking the court to hypothesize. This is a very busy circuit. I think it's the busiest in the nation. What I'm asking the court to do is clarify. As to the injunction, at some point I would like to get to the issue of ownership because I think there's a fundamental problem in judgment as a matter of law. But what I would like the court to do is to give further guidance and clarification on the issue of fair use because Thomas McClary is entitled
to use. You want
to
us
use.
To say, though, if I hear it in substance, that fair use would mean the following. If McClary were to say, A, that would be okay. If he alternatively were to say B, that too would be okay. But if he says C, that wouldn't. That's the kind of guidance you're looking for, isn't it?
Well, what I'm trying to do is avoid future litigation.
Is that the kind of guidance you're looking for?
For clarification on fair use, yes, I am.
Okay,
so
why wouldn't that amount? Why wouldn't that amount to asking us to postulate the possibility that you might want to do this and that would be okay, but you might want to do that and that wouldn't? It looks to me like you're asking for.
If the court would like to indulge in that,
looks,
the court is free to
please,
do so.
Please let me finish.
Certainly, Your Honor.
It looks to me what you're asking us to do is to give something that would be very advisory in nature. Maybe I'm misapprehending that.
Exactly. That's my concern. So that's why I'm asking the court to clarify fair use. My concern is that, first of all,
but you understand that we're generally not in the business of giving advisory opinions.
Correct.
We have enough difficulty deciding
I understand
cases and controversies when we have real conflict.
I understand that. So what I'd like to do is, if I've answered Your Honor's questions
all
as
right.
to the fair use, what I'd like to do is move to the issue
sure.
of the other problem with the injunction and then move back to the issue of the ownership.
Sure.
Because we don't even get to the injunction if the court agrees that this judgment as a matter of law takes an entire body of case law out of the Third Circuit, the Second Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and rejects that body of case law that recognizes that multiple band owners can own the trademark. It's separate from use. They can't all go out and play the Commodores. but they get to own it. The courts do not divest them of their ownership rights. But before we get there, let me answer the other question which Your Honor raised regarding the injunction, which is the injunction took no evidence at trial. There was no hearing for the permanent injunction, and the injunction did not go through the Bulova factors, which were more specified in Vanity Fair, in particular the issues of comedy and substantial effect. And this circuit in International Cafe has also adopted the substantial effects standard. So there's no analysis of that, and there's no determination whether Thomas McCleary should even be adjoined outside the United States for working the mark. Why do we say that? When we look at cases like Gucci, Juicy Couture, out of the Second Circuit, those are district court decisions. When we look at International Cafe, in the case of Juicy Couture, it was a website. In the case of Gucci, it was a defendant that was actually assisting the trademark infringement.
So now, a panel of this court affirmed on the preliminary injunction.
Yes, Your Honor did.
And they reached a different conclusion about the extraterritorial
pursuant to the preliminary injunction standard.
Right. So why were they wrong?
They were.
Admittedly, we certainly are not bound by what they said there because that was simply on a preliminary record.
Your Honor,
but the position that they took went beyond the fact that it was preliminary in nature and made some more general observations. Why did they get it wrong?
Your Honor,
and maybe
it's
they
not
did.
An issue of right or wrong. It's an issue of the record.
Well, if they got
the
it right.
Has. It was
if
a
they got it right and it's applicable here, you lose on that issue.
Your Honor, it was a preliminary record as reflected in the recorded oral argument, and the appellee urged it was a preliminary record with minimal evidence pursuant to affidavits that were never subject to cross-examination. What we have presented to this court with detailed, exhausting record sites is to show that there is no support for any notion that there is a substantial effect of Thomas McCleary's live performances in Australia in the United States, even though the issue wasn't tried. May I move to the argument of joint ownership?
Before you get to that, I just wanted to ask you a little bit. I will give you the time. Don't worry about the time. I'm just looking for your help.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I want to do that.
There was actual confusion that was experienced in the United States in connection with the New York performance. Doesn't that suggest that it's likely that the use of the marks abroad would create confusion as well, abroad?
There are three responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, confusion is morphed into the issue of ownership, which brings me to the problem with the judgment as a matter of law. Ownership and confusion are two different things, and those are dealt in the case law by stating that the performers cannot perform under the Commodore's name, whether it's in the United States or overseas, without the permission and consent of the other performers. That's in Marshak versus Treadwell, in Kingsman, in Kasbaum, which is the Steppenwolf decision, in Grandin. That's recognized around the country. So as to that issue of confusion, that's easily remedied by obtaining the consent of the other performers or performing with a qualifier, in it, for example, the Commodore's apostrophe, Thomas McCleary. Now, let's address the other component of confusion, which is that confusion overseas performing before a live audience in Australia is impossible or close to impossible. Why would I possibly say that? Because in Australia, you have a completely different audience, you have a different exchange, you have different monetary terms, you have a audience that is never going to morph and mingle with the audience in the United States. And in fact, if there is any confusion currently going on, it is the confusion with Orange and King performing currently in the United States when it's just the two of them. So when people buy these tickets, what they're getting is simply Orange and King performing with other members of a band that are not the original Commodores. They think they're getting the Commodores with backup recordings King's holding a guitar, but he's not playing it. He's a trumpeter.
Let me ask a slightly different question. I noted that the corporation Fifth Avenue filed for a community trademark in the European Union, sort of the equivalent of a federal registered trademark in the United States. As best I could tell, there was no record evidence offered that a community trademark had actually been granted or had been issued by the Office of Harmonization in the Internal Market. Do I have that right?
Yes, Your Honor, in the sense that they have they hold the mark, but there was a pending application for cancellation of the mark. This is outside the record.
No, I'm just
like
asking
to answer
so
your
record,
questions.
No, I'm just asking a simple record question.
There
the record does not reflect whether or not a CTM had been granted or issued or denied by that office yet, correct?
I believe
is that correct?
It is, but it's procedurally a little bit different, if I can just clarify, because
sure.
I don't want to misstate. The CTM was challenged by CEC, CEC Commodore, not plural, Entertainment Corporation. That was challenged. That is still in litigation. That has not been resolved. But they originally did have their trademark filed, held the mark. So until it's challenged, as Your Honor appreciates, in the United States, trademarks are developed by use, subsequently registration. Outside the United States, they're developed by registration. There are also trademarks that Thomas McCleary holds in New Zealand and Switzerland. But because the issue wasn't litigated, that is the extraterritorial injunction, he wasn't able to present any of that.
I understand that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May I address the issue of joint ownership?
You can certainly aid into the rebuttal time if you'd like.
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor.
No, if you want to go on now, you can, but at this point you'll be sort of on your dime rather than ours.
Let me briefly address one point, and then whatever seconds I have on rebuttal,
sure.
I'll talk as quickly as I can from Eastern North Carolina. On the joint ownership issue, this is critical because in the band context, the law recognizes that multiple band members who are founders of the band make the mark. They cumulatively, jointly, and CEC concedes in its answer brief that they are jointly the owners of the mark. So what we have here, yes, Your Honor, you had a question.
I was just going to say, that was very perceptive, by the way. All I did was like flinch and you stopped. That was nice. But I mean, it seems to me like you've got a flurry of agreements that seem to say that leaving members leave their rights behind. You've got case law out of the Ninth Circuit in this Roby versus Reed case, which seems effectively on point, which says the same thing. And then the Jurado decision out of this court, not quite on point, but effectively says the same thing. So how do you stand up against the agreements in the existing case law?
That is what CEC relied on, but the agreements say that you have to leave, and that's the fundamental problem.
Well, I get it that there might not be an abandonment in the sort of the term of art sense, but is there a leaving?
No, Your Honor, because the litmus test for departure, Marshak versus Treadwell discusses this, the litmus test for departure is not whether you're standing on stage jointly performing with the band. The question is whether you are continuing to work the mark. And the problem with this is Thomas McCleary, his partnership interests were never cashed out. There is
As a practical matter of fact, didn't he, in his own words, split from the band, end quote, in 1984 to pursue his own solo career and doesn't come back in any way, shape, or form for 24 years?
No, Your Honor, that is incorrect. Again, that's what CEC says, and
didn't he say that he split from the band in 1984 pursue his own solo career?
Pursue his solo career, as does
you say that in the blue brief.
Yeah, he uses the word split. But it doesn't mean that he left the band. His shares for the corporation were not cashed out. There's no evidence of that. His partnership interest, there's no evidence that his partnership interest cashed out. Even in 1984, when he purportedly signed a letter saying, I'm leaving the band and never returning, That's what we refer to as the sham Tommy letter. That's deemed forged.
But setting the letter aside, I mean, I think Judge Marcus's question is, setting aside the business formalities of his partnership interests and him receiving royalties, what in the real world was he doing with the band in the intervening two decades?
In 1984, McCleary continued to earn revenue performing as one of the Commodores. He attended numerous public events historically.
He would get royalties only on the stuff that he was involved in when he was with the Commodores. He wasn't getting royalties for new recordings that had occurred after he had left.
That is not necessary, Your Honor. Herb Reed makes
I'm
that
simply
very
asking
nice.
Whether that is accurate as a fact. I'm not asking you to spin the law for me. I'm just asking a simple fact question.
Yes, Your Honor, that's
he
correct.
He derived no royalties for any songs that might have been composed between 1984 and 2009.
Correct. And in 1984, he continued to appear on stage with the Commodores in 1985, 86. Again, to answer Your Honor's question, Judge Newsom, the Commodores, including McCleary in the state of Ashburn, ended their relationship with Motown and had them audited. He continues to be part of the band at that time. That's DE-380 at 2021. McCleary has always and still receives his royalties, which Your Honor asked about. That's DE-379 at 191, 371 at 84, 85.
Has he, though, been part of the artistic expression of the band?
Yes, he has. And this goes to the issue of joint ownership. That is the critical question. Because the question of whether you are divested of your rights to the mark, as defined in the Lanham Act under 1127, is whether you cease using the mark, use being the commercial use of the mark, not standing on stage always playing with the band, and with the intent never
so if
return.
I understand the essence of the argument, and help me if I don't have it right, although the member may have left the band and had no further involvement with it for an extensive period of time, the former band member still maintained common law rights to the name. For legal reasons.
Well, no, Your Honor, because
I have that
that's
wrong.
A conclusion.
I have that wrong.
That there's a part of your question that's incorrect.
Okay, help me with it.
Had no involvement with the band. That is not correct. He continued to be with the band. He's not on stage with them, but he was a fill-in guitarist with them.
On one occasion in 2009.
No, right? Your Honor, that's not the only.
Is there record evidence that he played with the band between
1984?
After that date.
Yes.
And before 2009, what record evidence is there that he played with the band?
Your Honor, he had, McCleary testified that he had played with the band.
When?
As a fill-in guitarist.
He doesn't give dates,
Your Honor, between 1984.
You understand why I asked the question?
I do counsel. Understand. I understand that all the
I
dates
thought,
are not.
And again, I may misapprehend the record, that he pinch hits and comes in and plays with the band, but that happens in 2009 and after 2009. As opposed to between 84 and 09. Maybe I've got those facts wrong, and if I do, just point me in the record to where I would get it right.
CEC admits as to a specific date that Thomas McCleary appeared with the Commodores as a guitarist in 2010. That's DE-380 at 16.
No, I understand. I'm sorry. I don't think you're getting my question.
I do understand, and I'm trying
to answer it. I understand
that
he appeared with the band subsequent to 09. I'm talking about prior to 09 and after 84, 85. Is there any record evidence that he actually either appeared on stage with the band or participated in creating a new song or something like that?
No, Your Honor. As to specific dates, no. Is there testimony supporting that he continued to work the mark as the Commodores and continued to have a relationship with Orange and King? Yes. As to specific dates that he continued to stand on stage with them? No, other than the dates that I provided, after the resignation letter in 1984, he was still on stage with them.
Got it. Thanks
he was
very
on
much.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your time.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Support. I'm Lindsay Lopez, and with me is Dean Kent. We're here on behalf of Commodores Entertainment Corporation, and I want to jump right into where the court left off. There is record testimony from Mr. McCleary that between 1985 and 2010, he did not perform with the Commodores, with the active Commodores, which is Mr. King, Mr. Orange, and Mr. Nicholas, who have been continually using the mark since the 80s through today, have been continually touring, have continued to record music, have continued to make all the decisions with respect to the band. They have made the decisions with regard to the hiring, the firing of band members, including bringing Mr. McCleary on for two occasions in 2010 as a fill-in guitar player. They've made all the creative
decisions. Did he fill in as a guitar player between 84 and 2009?
No, and his testimony is really unequivocal on that. You can look back at his cross-examination, and he's asked.
But he does fill in 10.
In 10.
Was that one performance, or was that multiple
performances? There were two performances in 2010.
Can I ask you about the ownership question? Because I do think that's messy. So the first time this case came to our court, the instructions on remand was that the district court should clarify and address, quote, comprehensively any issues surrounding the party's standing, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I don't think the district court did that. This is just my effort to hear from you.
Absolutely.
In response to my question. How I read the district court order, he says basically the 11th Circuit told me to address this comprehensively, and he just says, there's uncontroverted testimony of King and Orange about the terms of the general partnership agreement. And he says he's, quote, carefully considered the question. I mean, kind of conclusory stuff.
I would say, Your Honor, on this record, that a Rule 50 motion was appropriate because of the evidence that was in the record. What the court found is at the time that Mr. King and Mr. Orange transferred the mark, made the assignment of the mark to CEC, they were the only remaining members, and they both testified.
Well, let me, McCarthy, there's, this dispute about whether he withdrew from the partnership. He says he didn't.
I understand.
You say he did, right? I mean, that's a dispute, right?
I understand that he says that he didn't, but what's undisputed is that he didn't come back. He had two performances.
But I'm not talking about performing. I'm talking about the legal act of withdrawing from the partnership.
I understand that he disputes whether there's no dispute about whether he attended any meetings. That's another question that was asked from him. I know he says he didn't leave the band. I don't know that that has any legal significance.
But no, I'm not talking about the performing. I'm talking about withdrew from the partnership. I mean, the district court refers to that as a, quote, tempest in a teapot. But if he actually was still a member of the partnership, then that would relate to whether or not other members of the partnership could convey the trademark, right?
It may, if he was an active member of the partnership, it would have a relationship there. But there was no evidence that he had any continuing relationship with the partnership, that he had any meetings, that he showed up for anything at that point.
So, my understanding. So, in 1984, there was the amended partnership agreement, right?
Correct.
Okay, and that says that the partnership holds the trademarks pretty clearly, right? I mean, that's what the 84 agreement says. It's actually clearer than the 78 agreement in that regard, right?
I think so. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then it's after that that the quote Tommy letter it was dated, right? Okay. Right, I think that's right.
Really, it would be, yes.
Okay, so if it's true that that letter was a sham and that Mr. McCarthy never withdrew from the partnership, then how could two of the partners transfer the entirety of the trademark to CEC?
I think it comes down to the issue of whether when he left the band. So when he left the partnership, when he stopped performing.
I know. I mean, my question assumes that he did not leave the band. But,
I understand the question, Your Honor, but I don't think that there's any reasonable way to.
I know, but you got to assume my question for you in order to help me understand. So, I mean, we get you know, we ask hypothetical sometimes. So except for me that he's still in the partnership at the time that King and Orange transfer their trademark to CEC, that would be a problem, right? I mean, they don't have the legal they don't have the legal ownership of the entire trademark at that point, right?
They would be two of three members at that point if they're in that would have the ability to, as a majority, make a decision to transfer them.
Oh, so that's your argument. I mean,
my argument, of course, is that he left the group, that he was no longer.
Right, right, right.
That and that they were the only remaining members who would have had any ability. He wasn't making any decisions with respect to the partnership. He wasn't making any of the hiring and firing decisions. He wasn't making any actions as a partner of the group. He admits he didn't come to any more meetings. He didn't consult with them on any of these issues. That's his testimony.
So can I ask a question? I think I'm getting terms, perhaps terms of art, kind of confused in my own head, and you can sort this out for me. I hear abandonment, withdrawal, leave, split. Do those things mean different things? And is this ownership question in a multi-member band scenario, does it ride on sort of formality or pragmatic considerations about sort of in the real world what happened?
I think abandonment is a true term of art. That's the standard that requires non-use and intent not to
right.
use. I think the court can get there on abandonment, but I don't think
as a matter of law?
As a matter of law, I do. But I don't think that you have to, because I think that there are at least two other concepts that are spelled out in the case law, one that the district court really relied on, which is the Roby versus Reed. It's the same type of concept that's in the Giammarisi versus Delphi.
Although Mrs. Roby was never the owner of the trademark.
Correct, but that's what the court finds. The court finds that when he left, he didn't have anything to transfer to her. Not years later. They said, you left the band and you left the marks with the band. So I agree she was never the owner of the trademark, but that's because the assignment could have never been valid. He had nothing when he left, which is the same holding in the Giammarisi case about the band Deep Purple, and it talks about the band name being partnership property, and so there's no ability for the partner to use it separately. There's no individual right to it. So you don't have to get to non-use and intent not to use and a two-year prima facie evidence. It's just it doesn't belong to you.
It's sort of an effective walk-away standard. I mean, it's not abandonment as a matter of law. It's something less than that. Is that what you're saying?
I don't think you have to get to abandonment.
Yeah, but so I think what you're saying is, Judge Newsom, when you talk about abandonment, sort of for purposes of my secondary argument, set that aside, and it can be something less than that. It's leaving or splitting or whatever, and not in the real world being part of day-to-day band activities, be it performance or management.
Correct.
That's what Roby talks about.
That's what Roby talks about. And
Roby talks about the rights to the name belong, in their words, to members who remain continuously involved in the group and are in some position to control the quality of the services being provided.
Yes, Your Honor. There's another.
So that's what Judge Newsom characterized as a real world answer, as opposed to maybe a different juridical answer coming from some other source. But what you have in this case are a series of agreements. We've got to give some meaning to them. And we have some what's conceded by the parties, which is that between X and Y date, he's not involved with the group in the sense of performing with them, participating with them, meeting with them, coming up with ideas for songs, creating songs, recording songs, really doing anything like that. But he says, I was still with the band anyway, notwithstanding the fact that effectively, as a practical matter on the ground, I split from the band, to use his words.
Correct, Your Honor.
So his argument is, I don't disagree with the real world in the sense that I wasn't there and I didn't do anything, and they were there and they did do many things, and yes, it was true for almost 25 years, but I still had some legal right because I didn't formally withdraw, notwithstanding what the contract said. What is your response to that?
Well,
that is the argument she's making, if I have it right.
I think there's a couple of responses to that. One is if he believes that he has some continuing ownership interest in the partnership or in the corporation, CEC, that's a separate matter. If he believes he should have been bought out or that there should have been some purchase for that, then he could certainly take that up. We would have other defenses to that, but that's not this matter, because it's not the matter of whether he has a right to make an independent use, separate from the group, his own competing use of the Commodore mark.
And you say the contractual language bars him from doing that?
I say the contractual language?
Among other things.
Bars him from doing that?
Where in the contractual language is he barred? Tell me specifically. Sure.
There are the two separate partnership agreements that the parties entered into. Looking for the exact language. The first general partnership agreement from 1978 says no individual partner or combination of partners may render any performance or services or sell any product utilizing the partnership name, I'm skipping some language, but without the written consent of all partners. And then that same agreement says upon the death or withdrawal of less than a majority of the partners, the remaining partners shall continue to have the right to use the name. There are several agreements that come after that. None of them change that provision. And then there is a 1984 agreement in toto that says, again, upon the death or withdrawal of less than a majority of the partners, the remaining members continue to have the right to use the group name for any purpose. There are two agreements.
That was signed by all five of them.
By all of them, including Mr. McCleary, yes.
Right.
And there also is the Motown agreements, which Motown's not a party to this, but they all acknowledged in two separate Motown agreements that they would not use the name separately.
Could not use the name.
Could not use the name separately.
Would not. It wasn't precatory.
No,
it was mandatory.
Absolutely. There's one other question that I wanted to be sure to cover. It relates to fair use and relates to the scope of the injunction. And Your Honor's correct. We do not have a problem with Mr. McCleary making fair use of the mark. It's difficult to come up with every.
Right, but the point that she makes, and it's an interesting one, is that's fine stated at the highest order of abstraction. But how am I to know? You say I can do this, that's fine, but I want to do something a little bit different. How do I know whether I can do that unless you tell me?
Well, I don't know. It's impossible for us to predict every.
Well, she told you what she wanted to do here. Well,
I would say anything that bills him as the Commodores.
Could she do what she wanted to do?
I say no.
Because?
That's the Commodores. That's saying you're the Commodores / you're Thomas McCleary. You can say you're Thomas McCleary, and under classic fair use, which is discussed in the Cairns case, you can say I'm Thomas McCleary, and I can use your mark to describe who I am, which is I'm Thomas McCleary, the founder of the Commodores.
Right, so you can say who I am and what my relationship had been with that group.
Absolutely.
And so the name, the Commodores, can be used in the same statement with his name.
Right. You can give accurate factual information, but you cannot use the mark. You cannot say, I am the Commodores, because that's their mark, and there is actual confusion. There's evidence of actual confusion as a result of him billing himself as the Commodores featuring Thomas McCleary.
And just so I'm clear, setting aside your sort of litigation position or your client's representations through you in the brief, I think she was saying earlier that she was reading from reading from the injunction. Would the injunction permit what you and Judge Marcus are discussing?
On its face, I'm not sure if it uses exactly which words, but it says you can make classic fair use of the mark under Cairns.
But it doesn't explain.
It does not. It doesn't.
Fair use.
And I think it would be really difficult to come up with every.
It would be kind of advisory in nature for us to hypothesize.
It would be advisory, yep. And it would be impossible to come up with every iteration that they may want to use and say whether or not that would be appropriate.
Let me ask you a different question. In the motion to dismiss, Mr. McCleary claimed that LePred was an indispensable party because he was an original member of the Commodores who had claimed partial ownership of the marks. Is that issue of joinder inextricably intertwined with the permanent injunction? If the answer is no, it seems to me we don't have any jurisdiction to address that now.
I don't think it is. I'm trying to think about that for a minute.
Right.
Presumably, it could be. You may have jurisdiction over this because this is an issue about whether or not he should have been in front of the court to talk about the relative rights of the parties. But I would say that I don't believe there's any real basis to say that Mr. LaPrade is an indispensable party.
Right. I'm asking a different question. The question I'm asking is not going to the merits of whether Ms. Easley is right or wrong about that, but whether we have the power to entertain it on the front end at this point. And I don't think that we do unless we could honestly say it's inextricably intertwined with the injunction, which is plainly and properly before this court, because this case isn't over.
Correct, Your Honor. There's a phase two coming.
I mean, this is a provisional interlocutory, even though it's the review of a permanent injunction. And she's right. She has every right to be here on that. I'm just asking about the dismissal issue.
I would say that I see those issues as very separate. So I would say the court doesn't have jurisdiction to address it.
Thank you very much. Ms. Easley, you had used your time, but we'll still give you the 3 minutes for rebuttal. But we will keep you to 3 minutes, unless we've got questions. Unless we have questions that take you over that.
I'd like to give the court some record sites to address Your Honor's questions previously on the issue of performing, which is DE 371 at 123-124. Again, Thomas McClary did not specify dates. DE 379 at 246. Again, not specifying particular dates when he is still performing with the Commodores, but he does not have to perform in the case of Marshak versus Treadwell, and then the subsequent Treadwell USPTO TTAB decision. Those cases concern managers. Benny Ashburn, the manager of the Commodores, also had a trademark in the Commodore's name. You need not be a performer. Roby Reed turns on, and we quote the language. This is why lawyers have to read the full opinions that the judges labor over. What drove Roby versus Reed was not that he walked off the stage. He engaged in a complete cessation. He wasn't even collecting royalties. He's in prison. Once he's incarcerated, he's not touring then. And then he died, and we know he's not performing then. So there was absolutely no continued use of the mark as the Lanham Act defines it. And the Lanham Act talks about commercial use of the mark. So if Thomas McClary is going off, who developed the signature style, is going off and playing his guitar authentically, and the audience is hearing songs that he co-wrote, co-produced, authentically performing, he is working the mark as the Lanham Act defines it. The other thing, Your Honor asked questions about partnership versus ownership. The partnership agreement, the one that's operative because the previous agreement was subsumed within the GPA in toto, because there is an integration clause at the end of the GPA in toto that says this is an entire agreement.
1984 agreement.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. So in the partnership agreement, the GPA in toto, you had to withdraw by a writing. You didn't withdraw sub silentio. There had to be a writing. That's DE 361-1 at 17. In addition, pursuant to that partnership agreement, just like the one before, if McClary had withdrawn from the partnership agreement, he had to be cashed out.
Let me ask you a question about
the
agreements itself. Going back, let's say, just take, for example, the 79, CEC enters into an exclusive artist production agreement with Motown.
Yes,
Records.
The one ending in 1985.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the 79 agreement itself. And in it, it said, among other things, band members could perform as sidemen for other groups, but in no event could they use the name Commodores in connection with that side engagement. And then it says, the members and the group as a whole, quote, would jointly and not severally, the sole and exclusive owner of all rights in and to the name. This is like the general partnership agreement, but it suggests that they don't have, the ownership was joint and required the continuing involvement with, as opposed to there was some residual right that they may have had, even if they didn't participate with the group for an extended period. That's what I'm sort of getting at with this language.
Sure.
How are we to read that?
And if I may, just to tack on.
Certainly.
The same agreement, I think, goes on to say that no leaving member will have the right to make any individual use of the name.
That's right, Your Honor.
The exact language is, it says, in addition, if one or more members become a leaving member, then the remaining members automatically and without notice would become jointly the sole and exclusive owners of the rights to the name. I think that's what you're referring to.
That's right, Your Honor. And my response to that is threefold. First of all, the first agreement to which Your Honor referred, that agreement was no longer in effect because there's a subsequent Motown agreement that became in effect, the 1983 Motown agreement. But this is standard language in contracts because the recording company generally wants to deal with the corporation and they don't want performers going off and performing on their own. But neither of those agreements controlled the partnership when Thomas McCleary entered into the GPA in toto, which was in 1984. So the Motown agreement gets entered into, the subsequent Motown agreement gets entered into in 1983 and subsumes the previous 1979 Motown agreement. We've got the GPA in toto that says the partnership holds the agreement. It doesn't say own, but it says holds. So own is pursuant to the law, and the language helps us in the Motown agreement. The joint ownership of these partners, and that's why Marshak versus Treadwell, Kingsman, Steppenwolf, Grondin are all being decided the way they are, because we protect the founding members' rights. Whether they're all on stage still performing, they are not divested of their ownership rights and what they created. But what they can't do is they can't all go out and perform separately as Steppenwolf.
I think we have it, so if you could just bring it to a conclusion, we'd
certainly
be much appreciated.
Certainly, Your Honor. Thank you, and I appreciate the
Thank you all
indulgence.
For your efforts.
Thank you.
This court will be adjourned.
Thank you.